The Observer's Calendar for April 2024 on episode 414 of the Actual Astronomy Podcast. I'm Chris, and joining me is Shane. We are amateur astronomers who love looking up at the night sky, and this podcast is for everybody who enjoys going out under the stars and does not mind their podcast numbering out of sequential order.
Yeah, you know, we both missed this one.
I don't know.
I thought about it, and I just, you know, if I don't do something in the moment, I often just lose track of it. And that's what happened here. I lost track of it. And I should probably start putting these in my calendar as a reminder to say, hey, this coming weekend, think about the Observer's Calendar.
That's right. Because, and I was a little bit better than you, but, or maybe worse, depending on how you look at it, is I had remembered that there was a podcast episode that needed notes. And I started making, like, I put in up to 414, because I knew in the back of my mind that we needed 414 episodes by this point, but I couldn't remember why that was.
Oh, well.
But here we go. This is, this month will be this will be the start of our fifth year doing this. So that's something.
Wild. Yeah. That went by pretty fast.
Just like a pandemic.
Yeah, there you go.
Did you get out and do any testing with your Frankenscope of a 90FL?
Well, I feel like a drum roll is appropriate, but then I'll just disappoint you. So I did not.
You did. So you got it set up though, didn't you?
Yeah. So let's catch up, everybody that's listening. So, you know, I got the Borg 90FL. It's super versatile.
It's basically a 3.5-inch refractor.
Yeah, and it's fairly fast. Like, it's what, F5.6 or something?
Yeah, something like that.
Or 5. Whatever. And as with all Borgs, you know, it's all modular and you can add things to do different stuff. And I tried the 1.5 times teleconverter. Didn't love it. So the next test was to use the, I think the
and
Borg...
The teleconverter, that takes it to F8-ish.
Yeah, somewhere around there. And why I didn't like it is it hangs off the back. Like, you attach it to the focuser because there's M57 threads on the focuser. So this thing just screws in. And then you put your 2-inch, I guess, what would it be called? Sort of, I don't know, nose piece, not a nose piece, but the thing that secures your diagonal that locks it in there. So you put that on there, you put your diagonal in, and away you go. The problem is it moved the focus way back, you know, because of course it extended the focal length essentially. So I had to add like a 4-inch extension tube and rack the focuser pretty much all the way out. And it just, it made it so back heavy that it was kind of unwieldy. And I didn't totally love the views either. Like, this telescope really is more about wide field views. So fast forward to the next test case, which was to use the reducer that came with it. And Borg has a number of reducers. The one that came with it is the, I think it's 7872, and it's like a 0.8 times, I believe. So It takes it from like F5 point, whatever it is, to I think 3.6. And for sure, the intended crowd is astrophotographers, but it can be used visually. And you were involved in a little bit of a small Cloudy Nights thread where this was being discussed a few years ago.
Yeah.
And one of the Cloudy Nights members posted exactly how he got this thing to work with his Borg 90FL in a visual mode.
Mm-hmm.
So it turned out that I needed one adapter. So I ordered that, received it. And I had all of the other parts. Essentially, what I needed to do, because this is reducing the focal length, is shorten the OTA, the optical tube assembly. So I took out a 10 centimeter tube length, or maybe it was a 15 centimeter tube length. And I replaced it with around 5 to 8 centimeters, somewhere in that range. I forget exactly where it's at. So really, really shrunk this thing. And I sent you a photo of it fully built. And the whole thing, like this is with the dew shield retracted, but the whole telescope was like 11 inches, something like that. Super small. But anyway, I put the reducer in there. I confirmed that I can achieve focus without any issue. with my APM 30 millimeter UFF, but I did that during daylight. So the real test would be under a nighttime sky. I was hoping to do it last night, but I had a work commitment that took me until about 9:30 PM. And by the time I got home, I was kind of done for the night. But it's looking clear, Chris, for tonight. So I might try to sneak out for a quick view just to see how it works and, see if it's worth pursuing in this current configuration.
Like, yeah, even in the city, I'd be curious to see on something like the Pleiades or, you know, like a, some sort of cluster or group of faint stars, just to see how the edge performance is.
Yes.
And, yeah, just in general, you know, how big the field of view is. Cause if you're at, even at F4, I'm not exactly sure what you got there, but at a 90 millimeter aperture, and then with a 30 millimeter eyepiece, then you'd be looking at basically something like 10 magnification. You would lose some of the light because your exit pupil is large, but that eyepiece is like 70 odd degrees. So, you know, having a 90 millimeter scope that's reduced down to 75 millimeters or something like that, but giving over a 7 degree field of view, it what it does is it gives you the widest possible field of view that you can ever achieve in a refractor with as much light as you can ever achieve. So you really, you know, end up with this exquisite wide field machine. If the stars are sharp to the edge and it has a flat field, then that is a rare gem of a scope, and I'll regret not buying the one that went for $1,300 Canadian last week. Right. So,
well, and here's something promising. So while I was testing it during daylight hours, there's some buildings near me that have, siding that, you know, is applied horizontally. So you have a whole bunch of horizontal lines across a long building, and it's actually a really good test for edge performance in a telescope or any kind of, you know, curvature that might exist in your optical path. And this was super flat. Like, the lines were perfectly straight and they were sharp to the edge. However, there's nothing like testing it on stars. So, you know, I will still hold out, you know, for my final conclusion on this, but it is looking promising so far. So, like I say, I'm really hoping to take it out, even if it's just for like 10 minutes tonight, to have a few quick looks, and just see how it performs.
Awesome.
Yeah. Did you do any observing?
No, not in the past couple of days. It's been clear. It has been cold and windy, rather cold at times. We're down to minus 16, minus 18 kind of thing, and pretty much a full moon. And I'm just like, bleh, I have other things to attend to, working a little bit on the calendar at night, even though the many volunteers may not also see. It's like I pick one thing and try to do with like one small thing on the calendar every night. Was chatting with Wade, our friend down in Australia, and he thinks he figured out the bolt that I need to get my secondary mount working on the AZEQ6. Yeah. So hopefully we don't get too much snow on Friday when the weather changes over to be warm. And I'll probably take a run out, even though it's just there, I'll probably take another run out and grab that secondary folder and bring it back. I just ordered the bolts. Now, it's a whole pack of bolts you got to buy. It's $20, but he seemed pretty firm in his conviction. And like, I hope I don't get this wrong, but he definitely is somebody that knows more about machining stuff than me. I think he even machined stuff himself. So definitely a pretty capable person. I did remind him that I'm not a fraction of mechanically inclined as he is. So he's going to, we'll probably do a Zoom session or something, and he'll walk me through whatever to get that saddle apart, especially since, like, there's a good point that was made that if I wreck it, it's like I'm no further behind because I can't use it now. You know, as is, it kind of sort of works, but it does, it will spin if you don't do it very, very carefully, and you can't mount anything heavier than the 60 millimeters. So that's that. Yeah.
Well, at least there's some hope there.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's lots of hope there. He seemed to feel fairly confident. He swapped out his bolt for one reason or another. He didn't like the bolt that was there and swapped it out. So if I do get it working, it will work better than what it would have originally. Anyhow, so it's exciting.
Yeah, that's awesome.
We heard from Michael Wright, and he's the president of the Kitchener-Waterloo KW Center. And he sort of picked up on our spring observing plans and sent us his. If there's listeners out there that want to send in theirs, you can send them into actualastronomy@gmail.com. But maybe I'll read Michael's email really quick before we get going, because I thought it was pretty interesting and maybe inspire other people to get out, if that's okay with you.
Absolutely.
Michael says, "Hi, guys. Just finished episode 410. I am getting more into observing planetary nebula lately." Because we did the show on Herbert Curtis and his planetary nebula from 1918. Michael goes on to say, "Back when I only had my 4.5-inch Newtonian, I neglected planetary nebula as I maxed out at 120 magnification, or 120x, and didn't have access to filters due to the 9.25 or the 0.965-inch eyepiece barrels I was limited to. I just didn't think it was worth it. I did try to see many of them, but they were too small and I could not make out any detail or even differentiate many of them from stars. The only ones I observed back then were the Messiers. That would be like Messier 57 and M27 and M76, and also the Helix, Collarbone Nebula and Orion, Skull Nebula and Cetus, and the Ghost of Jupiter and Hydra, which I think is up pretty high now. People should check that one out. And also the Cat's Eye Nebula up there in Draco. I tried for a few others, but got really frustrated. Looking forward to overcoming that with the 12-inch and filters this spring. My spring observing project is to get through all the Ursa Major targets on the RASC Finest NGC list, in addition to a few highlighted in O'Meara and Sue French's books. I started this project last year, but the spring had a lot of smoky skies. And when there were clear nights, I didn't get to go through everything I wanted and should probably reobserve the ones I didn't get to tackle or the ones I didn't see as well. These include the Tiger's Eye Galaxy, Helix Galaxy, Phantom Frisbee, and the Bow and Arrow Galaxy. At least the supernova M101 last spring was visible even when the smoke was in the sky, and I was able to make out the spiral arms of the galaxy, although they were barely visible at those times. Here's hoping for a good run of clear skies before wildfire season begins." Michael, well, thanks for that, Michael.
Yeah, Ursa Major is well positioned right now for some good observing. It's nice and high in the sky.
Had a few people write in because I was talking about keeping eyepieces warm and the cost of heater trees. Yeah, I shouldn't be surprised anymore, but I'm always a little bit surprised on what people pick up on and what they write in about. This is one of those situations where I had no idea people had sourced alternative heaters and eyepiece warmers for their equipment. Had you heard of any people doing this before? I'd never heard of any of this before.
I have not. It's also something I've never really researched. Like, I've never had much of an issue with my stuff fogging up or doing up, I should say. So I don't know. I've never really researched it. But as people started telling us about their creative ways to heat their eyepieces, it's like, oh, yeah, that really makes sense. And, you know, sometimes the simple solution is the best solution.
So out east, of course, we do get much more dew and frost and that sort of thing. So typically what I do is I just develop my own way of dealing with things, which is just open up the eyepiece case, take your eyepiece out, close the eyepiece case. It's always closed, basically, and that seems to more or less do the trick. But since I started with the observing and my sessions have been longer, maybe it is that these people are pretty experienced people and maybe they're just doing longer sessions than I ever was anyway. However, yeah, since the observatory has gotten running, then yeah, I've run into a few more challenges. Let's see, Bill, had written, and he wrote about, and this is Bill Weir, friend of ours. And Bill had written about using a seed starter heater. And I guess you can buy these flat panels and they plug in somehow You know, by the way, none of this is an approved electrical recommendation. Of course, I don't know what the safety spec is on using some of the stuff outdoors in the dew, but you're not going to be out in the rain and whatever. So just use your common sense. We're not endorsing any of this, and we're not using the stuff for its intended purpose either. But Bill said you can use a seed starter kit. And it's like a flat board, and you can put your eyepieces on it or, you know, whatever, and that it doesn't get all that warm. The other one we heard from, and I think a few people wrote with this, and Mark was the one that I remembered off the top of my head, but he wrote about using just a little heating pad, just like one you might use for your leg or back or something of that nature.
Yeah. So. I think Alistair was using something similar, wasn't he? Some sort of a small heating pad, and put it in a box and put some eyepieces in there.
Yeah, he mentioned that. And then he also mentioned this. This was the wackiest one so far. I think it was Alistair. Correct me if I'm wrong. And if you're the person who sent this, this was the craziest one. And that was a lizard heater. And I guess if you are a person who has lizards for pets, because of the cold-blooded nature of the lizards, you need to put some sort of heating element in. I remember my cousins had iguanas and stuff, they would have like heating rocks, but I guess you can just get like a flat panel, and it's like just like a, you know, I guess these are almost the size of a sheet of paper, a little bit smaller, and then you could maybe stick that on whatever surface or in your thing, and you could power it from, many of these could be powered from like just like a USB battery pack or whatever. And you know, I think Alistair said that it doesn't give off a tremendous amount of heat. In fact, you'd barely notice it at minus 20, but definitely would be enough to keep your eyepieces from cooling quickly and keep the dew off them. So I thought that was pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I think that's great.
Bill also sent some sketches. He sent this one of NGC 2392 up in Gemini, which is a planetary nebula. And this was using his 20-inch F3.3 at 480 magnification.
Wow.
That is a beautiful planetary nebula sketch.
It is. Yeah, it's really, really good.
If I've ever seen one. Wow. That is, yeah, Bill's done a lot of observing and sketching. And when you see stuff like this from a really experienced person, it just, you know, really makes me want to go observe with a 20-inch telescope with Bill.
Yeah, no kidding.
That's pretty sweet.
Love
all
it.
Right.
Just before we get into the next one here too, I don't know if you had a chance to listen and read some of Phil's email. He was doing some solar observing and did a wonderful sketch of an enormous sunspot group. And this is pretty fresh. So when this episode drops, if there are any solar observers out there, take a look, because this group was enormous, and Phil did a great job to capture a lot of detail in those sunspots. And just wanted to mention that for the solar observers, that there's still a lot of activity going on there.
Yeah, I meant to add something, and thanks for that, because Phil had sent us a voicemail, and I'd listened to it and replied while I was listening to it, and I sort of had hit send when I was only about 3/4. Then there was some other stuff, so then I sent him an additional email, and I just end up getting sidetracked. So thanks for that. Appreciate it.
Yeah, for sure.
We have a few things coming. One thing that's been in the news, Shane, have you heard about this possible T Corona Borealis nova that may occur either this spring or summer or later this year? Have you heard about this?
Yeah, I have. It's interesting. Like, it seems like this nova has kind of a periodic cycle of, I forget, what is it, around 70 years, or it's a more precise number than that.
80 years, I think, is what they've narrowed it down to, plus or minus several months. And it started going through that initial cycle about this time last year. And then it, like, technically speaking, it should have gone by the early part of this year. So they figure it's overdue. But there was a NASA article in February talking about this, and all the media outlets seem to have picked up on it. So it could be something to watch out for in the coming months. But it's one of those things that they've observed it twice. One was in, I think, 46, and then in the late or the 1880s, maybe 1860s, I guess. And but it's only been observed twice before, which might not be enough observations to fully understand what's what's going on there, because I think in a few weeks we're definitely well into the overdue mark. But if the science proves out, then yeah, we could have a decently bright nova there. I think one of the stars is as faint as like 11th magnitude or something, and you know, if an object suddenly brightens up to well above naked eye visibility, then yeah, it would be pretty cool to be able to see a nova from you know, downtown Toronto or something like that. If you had a pair of binoculars, you should be able to pick it up.
Yeah, and that's what I've heard, is that it could go naked eye brightness. So, you know, something to prep for would just be to visually look at Corona Borealis when you're out and just get a little more familiar with the star field. And, you know, if one night there's a new star there, you know what you're looking at.
Yeah, I don't think we'll, I thought about getting into it here, but I think we don't want to confuse the facts, which that sometimes happens in the news stories. And I could see online, just in reading forums and stuff, where some people had become confused that it was already occurring, but it is not. This hasn't happened, and as a matter of fact, there's nothing to say 100% that it will happen, because it has only been observed twice. They just all indications are that it should happen sometime before September. They're saying between February and September, I think, but the focus is on the April sort of time frame. First 2 weeks of April really should be, you know, if once we get much beyond that, then maybe there's something else going on there. Who knows?
Mm-hmm.
Pretty cool though. Always something happening up there.
Yeah, no kidding.
Something big happening next month too. So that's one of the reasons why we didn't want to forget to do this one.
Oof.
April 1st, this is not the thing, but what I'm referring to is the April 8th solar eclipse, but we'll get to that in a second. April 1st, zodiacal light is visible in the west for 2 weeks. So for the next 2 weeks. So once we get past the bright moon phase, when the moon is more towards full than not, and once we're into more of the dark moon period, when the moon is less full than it is not, then what we're going to have is dark enough skies in the evening to see the zodiacal light, which looks like a giant pyramid-ish in the western sky. Almost looks like Milky Way, and sort of tucks in just beneath the Pleiades.
Yeah, this is the time of the year to observe it if you can.
Yeah, I've been going back and forth with Alistair a little bit on the Gegenschein and zodiacal light. So I'm like almost reluctant to say more, but we were chatting about this a couple of years back during the pandemic, and an article had come out stating that much of the material that we're seeing, and what we're seeing here, is particles that are they're in interplanetary space, meaning they're floating around between all the planets in our solar system. And at this time of year is when the angle is right to see it in the evening, over towards the western part of the sky, extending up from the western horizon to just about around the Pleiades. And it's inside the ecliptic, which is where all the planets hang out. And then because there's dust there, it's reflecting the sun back towards us, and the angle's right at this time of year. But it turns out that much of that dust, it wasn't necessarily left over from the formation of the solar system. The new theory that's kind of getting proven out is that much of that dust is getting blown off Mars, which mm-hmm. is kind of interesting.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Pretty cool stuff. But that's all I'm going to say for now. I'm kind of working away on some of that stuff for the calendar.
Cool.
April 2nd, we have the last quarter moon. For those that want to get up and observe the moon, there you go. There's one. I seldom observe the last quarter moon. Maybe I'll do it this time.
Well, I'm getting the itch to do some observing now that we're getting warmer temperatures. So I'll look at anything if it's nice out.
Good stuff. April 6th, we have Mars, Saturn, and the moon forming a triangle in the east sky at dawn. So just as things are starting to brighten up, you're up nice and early now because it's definitely getting bright at 6:30 when I go downstairs in the morning to start getting ready for my work day. I start not even making my coffee and the sun starts streaming in the window. So it's getting bright early, and that sun is up not too long after 6:30 now, and definitely next week it will be. So you can get up and go out and look for Mars, Saturn, and the moon forming a triangle in the east at dawn on April 6th. But yeah, that's going to have to be a before 6 a.m. type deal around here, I think.
Mm-hmm.
April 7th is International Dark Sky Week, and that works out well because on the 8th, we're going to have a total solar eclipse extending down from the Atlantic provinces all the way down through the states and into Mexico. It crosses over parts of New Brunswick, Ontario, and down through the states and all over the place in heavily populated areas. It's going to be a veritable zoo out there.
I wish
So.
everybody clear skies for that. That's attempting to observe it. Hopefully the weather cooperates. And I sent you that interesting screenshot of
Oh,
Sky
yeah. Sorry,
Safari.
talk about that.
So we've talked a little bit about, like, with the eclipse, there's a lot of details, about like during totality, the centerpiece obviously is the sun being eclipsed by the moon, and it's a beautiful sight. But around that, there's some other things that people might be able to see. One of them that we've talked about is Comet 12P Pons-Brooks. It's quite bright right now, and it might be visible during totality if if it's dark enough, and this remains to be seen. But the other interesting thing is that there's seven planets that will be visible. So you're going to have Uranus, Jupiter, Mercury, Venus, Neptune, Saturn, and Mars are all going to be lined up kind of along the ecliptic, and not too far away actually from the sun at totality. So it's kind of another neat thing to look at, is this kind of line of planets that'll intersect through the sun and kind of carry up along the ecliptic. So if you are on the path of totality, this is another thing to maybe add to your list. Now, I say maybe because the real star of the show is the sun in total eclipse. And once you see that, it's hard to take your eyes off of it. But if you want to take in some of these other neat things, there you go. You can check it out.
It and I mentioned this to you, it's almost like tempting in a way now that I'm looking at this and the image that you sent. I put it on our notes, so the photo source came from Reddit, but I think just about anybody running Sky Safari on their phone would be able to make the same sort of apparition. It would be really neat to just forego the solar eclipse. This is like sort of heretical speech, right?
Yeah, what are you saying?
But and then just take a long look at Mercury. Well, because you would get a in this instance, because it's just past greatest eastern elongation, that you're going to get a pretty good view of Mercury that far away from the sun and that high overhead, unlike virtually anybody has ever had before, versus solar eclipse. You could just go and maybe catch the next one. That could be something. That could be something.
If you do decide to observe that, I highly recommend you set an audible alarm on your phone that gives you like 10 or 20 seconds notice that totality is about to end, so that you get your telescope away from Mercury and away from the sun before you cause permanent eye damage.
Yeah, I mean that's always a good rule. Probably nobody will do that because you really are throwing away that solar eclipse experience if you do that. But at the same time, like the eclipse is long enough, 4 minutes, you can get it on there, and I mean you could have a pretty good view.
Yeah, have a quick look.
Yeah, it would be pretty amazing if you could even like if enough telescopes were set up and you were set up with other people or had multiple scopes going on your own, which could be a lot, but if you did have somebody that went the Mercury route and then or had another scope on Mercury and then at least just took that momentary view for like, commit 30 seconds of that eclipse experience to taking a look at it, you can see a lot in 30 seconds that you and I think that would be memorable. I really do. The comet, that's kind of a neat thing, but this comet is well visible right now. That would be kind of neat. I think that some of this stuff though does get kind of a bit distracting, especially for people that are going to be going to see an eclipse and not exactly sure what they're going to be seeing or whatever. If we start talking about planets and comets and all this other junk in the sky, that really the thing to see is that eclipse and the corona and all that kind of stuff. So people should really focus on the sun and not blinding themselves like you make such a good suggestion to set that alarm and make sure that you're being solar safe.
Yeah, and I'll just chime in too with my experience at the 2017 eclipse, and a lot of our listeners have heard this before, but you know, I did do some photography during that eclipse and I'm happy with my photos, but afterwards I had regret that I didn't spend enough time looking at the totality with my own eyes. And I was looking at it through a camera.
Mm-hmm.
So I made a vow to myself that the next one that I attend, I will not be doing any photography or any other distraction. I will look at the totality for as long as it possibly lasts. Just because it's so incredible and it's such a rare thing. So even if I was at this eclipse, I don't think that I would be looking for some of this other stuff. I think I would just, you know, observe the sun as much as I could for as long as I could. So that's my 2 cents.
Yeah. And neither of us are going to the eclipse. I made the decision to buy another telescope in the fall, and that's where my eclipse money has gone.
Yep.
Which I'll regret for that afternoon and that afternoon only, but probably wherever I went would have been cloudy anyhow. So yeah, it's all good. Anything else in the eclipse that we need to, I mean, people should have their plans already made. You know, this is going to come out only a few days, less than a week before the eclipse. So yeah, wishing people all the best.
Yeah, just good luck. Be prepared. You know what you want to look at. Have all of your timings down, and it will be hopefully a real fun event. I am taking that day off as vacation, and I will be setting up in the backyard, provided it's not cloudy. So we'll see how it goes here. I think we're about 40% eclipse in Regina.
Yeah, something like that. If you're looking for some company, I think I'm going to take the day off too. So
yeah, absolutely. Come on over.
Yeah. Yeah, if you don't mind, because I really don't have all that much solar gear, just like the glasses and whatever. And yeah, I think I'm going to, that would be awesome. Maybe we can do like a bit of, we could record a podcast.
Whoa.
Wouldn't that be funny? That'd be, what a great idea. Novel great idea.
Yeah.
We can talk about observing a partial eclipse and maybe I can convince a few people that I know or who are watching it to give us the experience of what it was like on the ground there. We can figure something out. That'd be cool.
Yeah, I like it.
All right. So, and people should write in with their eclipse experiences.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, actualastronomy@gmail.com. Love to hear them. April 10th, Jupiter and Uranus are going to be 4 degrees below the moon. So that's going to be kind of an interesting thing to see as well, I think.
Yeah. Always like it when Uranus or Neptune are close to the moon or some other kind of naked eye object. It just makes finding them a little easier.
And they're pretty close together in the sky there for a few nights in. And for most of the month of April, you can try tracking down Uranus. As it is, I think only a few degrees away from Jupiter for several nights in the middle of the month. Towards the end of the month, actually, I guess the 19th is, give or take, is the closest time. But on the 10th, between the 10th and the end of the month, it's pretty close right to Jupiter. So you have to sort it out though, because there's the moons of Jupiter. I think there's a few bright stars there too, and then Uranus nearby. So yeah, it could be pretty neat if you can get things to line up properly. Morning sky on the 11th, we have Mars, Saturn, and the Pleiades are only half degree apart for somewhere. I don't think it's here though.
Okay.
I put these ones in for other places, and I didn't run my software, but what I do is when I work on the dates and events for the calendar, I try to make sure that I'm not putting stuff in that's not visible in North America. And I did take this one out. So that means it's not as much an event for North America. You're going to get them kind of sort of in about the same spot in the sky, but they're not as close. Saturn and Mars don't move super quick. So they're probably going to be like a degree or so apart for here, which is still pretty cool. You can even see in that image you put from the 10th, they're pretty close together there. And so that's going to persist for everywhere, but they're on the, right on that, southwestern horizon. So southwest horizon.
Yeah, that'll be great.
First quarter moon is on the 15th. Lunar X is visible, and, that's near the crater Werner, and it's visible for all of North America. So I'm going to go out and try to observe this one as well. As part of my calendar work, I'm trying to verify visually a lot of these events and making sure that we're fairly accurate in how we represent things in the calendar, which I haven't done before. And what's enabling me to do this is I have other people working on the calendar. Probably some people, maybe even listening to this, wondering why I don't respond to emails or interject as much. But I'm actually going out and taking a look at some of this stuff, because the next night, April 16th, I'm going to be out looking at the lunar straight wall, which I took a look at just the other night here, and was chatting with Royce about that. Well, he did a sketch, and Shane sent you a photo and Royce a photo. And yeah, maybe I'll try to work up to doing a sketch when it's not super cold like it was that night.
Yeah, I like that.
And the X and the straight wall, well, they're a little bit different. So the X is, what is it, a clear obscure effect, I think, where it's just sort of the way the lines of light fall over the edge of the terminator or the shadow of the moon as it's making its slow journey across the surface.
Yes, indeed. And
something like that.
It's kind of a light play with what's illuminated and what's in shadow. And at times, if you're in the right place at the right time, you can see things like the lunar X or the straight wall, and they really jump out. The X is pretty neat. Well, they're both really neat. You know, like the X will really jump out along that terminator, and then the straight wall is quite large, and it really, you know, it really jumps out at you too, because here's this big block line in a otherwise, you know, what you typically will refer to as kind of just a bright crater without any sort of features like that, except on the 16th, you'll see it then.
And the lunar X is sort of an optical illusion, because there's no real X, so to speak. It's just like the way these crater rims kind of meet up when the light is a certain way.
That's a good point.
But the straight wall is a thing. It's like an escarpment. If anybody's in Southern Ontario, you have a big escarpment there, and that's what it is. It's, what is it, like 92 kilometers long and 2 to 3 kilometers across some places, and it's like a fault line or something, I think, really is what it is there. So that's the night around the 16th. On April 19th and 20th, that's when we have that Uranus and Jupiter close approach. They get down to about half a degree, so that could be a good night to try to take a look for Uranus.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's really close and would make a great pairing in a telescope for sure.
Yeah, I think that's going to be something to see. And because we get about almost 2 weeks there where it's well visible from, you know, about the 10th until the end of the month, then you got lots of opportunity to see Jupiter and Uranus in the same field view of I guess 60 power, 70 degree fields of view. Maybe you can get 70, 75 80 power with an 80 or 90 degree field of view to fit them both nicely into the same frame. Should be possible.
Good opportunity.
April 22nd, we have a very disappointing Lyrid meteor shower.
Yeah, anytime there's a full moon, and the full moon looks like it's the next day, your meteor shower gets washed out by the brightness of the moon.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
We have that comet Pons Brooks, I think, still kicking around here for a little while longer. Starts heading south soon.
Yeah, I was reading on, so somebody posted on Cloudy Nights today. They're viewing it with 10 by 50 binoculars. And the notes here on, so this is from Astro CY on Cloudy Nights. Let me just get to the good part here. So the coma looked more, this person observed the comet 3 days prior. And so this is a follow-up observation, and the notes here say the coma looked more condensed, the nucleus more evident, and the faint short tail more obvious. So this is all through 10 by 50s. And then I estimated its brightness at around plus 5.5. So that's getting quite bright. And 3 days ago, the estimated brightness was about magnitude 6. So it's gained potentially about half a magnitude here in a few days. Some of the predictions are stating it'll hit magnitude 4 potentially in April here. So definitely add this to your observing list, particularly if you're under a dark sky.
And it's pretty much going to be at Hamal, which is, or Hamel, depending on how you look at it, which is Alpha Arietis, or more simply put, the brightest star in the constellation of Aries, in regular person speak. I'm just firing up my planetarium software, but it's going to take a moment. But I'm
Yeah,
just trying
the
to
note
see.
here from Astro CY says it forms a triangle with Homol and Sheraton, so Alpha and Beta in Aries there.
Okay, and then I'm just going to scooch ahead here and just see where it's at. So here for us, it's dark at about 9 o'clock, and I've made it 9 o'clock, but I think our moon is probably up. We're getting close to being up by then. Let's
Wow,
see.
there are a lot of posts on Cloudy Nights about this. So lots to read if you're interested.
Yeah, I'm just going over to see if I can scroll around to find it, but it's pretty low, I think. Oh yeah, it's getting down there. Very low. So even if you want to get this right after, oh yeah, there it is. So yeah, I guess that doesn't work out too bad. Is it clear now?
Yeah, it's clear tonight.
Yeah, so yeah, I might grab the 12. Think I can see it in my 12 by 36s.
Well, that'll be interesting. I don't know. you might be pushing it. I'm reading here another report from yesterday. 257 millimeter f4.5 Newtonian. So that's what, 10 inches, something like that. So at 39 times, the nucleus was almost stellar. The coma was sharply defined on the leading edge and feathered away, but no tail visible. 64 times, the view remained sharp and bright. 105 times, still no tail and no difference in detail. 210 times, the nucleus was not easily discerned, but the coma was still sharply defined. 231 times the image softened, and 328 it no longer held up. So, interesting report there, considering the other report had 10 by 50s with a, oh, with a tail. But I tried to see 12p last night with my 12 by 36 IS binoculars. Planned to image it with my C-Star, but high cloud shut me out. Oh, well, sorry, Chris. Thought maybe we had something there for you.
This is like that Simpsons episode where Seymour Skinner's looking through the telescope and Bart is like sleepily doodling on a piece of paper and Seymour's reading out the location. 6 hours, 19 minutes, right ascension, 14 degrees, 22 minutes declination, no sighting.
Sorry, apologies.
Yeah. All right. I'm staying in. Full moon, minus 20 still. No. I don't know if it's minus 20, but it's not very warm out still. That's it. That's it. That's all the stuff that I had put in here. We're recording this on a special day and time because we have both forgotten about this, but we will get this show out to people so they get what to observe in the night sky for April of 2024. And this way nobody misses. Wouldn't that be, that would have been like a very strange thing if we had forgotten to do this one on one of the months where it's the most critical that people know there's a solar eclipse happening on April 8th, because I guess theoretically somebody could be listening to this show and that's how they find out about the solar eclipse, because this will go out on the 365 Days of Astronomy podcast. And lots of people listen to that who aren't maybe as committed amateur astronomers as some of the folks who are regular subscribers and listeners. But if you want to be a regular subscriber and listener, please do so and share the show with other stargazers you know. So, with that, Shane, do we have anything else to add to this episode for April of?
That's a wrap. Good luck with the comet. Good luck with the eclipse. And definitely send us any reports of either, or really just any general observing reports.
Thank you so much. Please subscribe, share the show with other stargazers you know. You can always send us your observing reports of the eclipse or otherwise. Your show ideas or any questions to actualastronomy@gmail.com.
Thank you everyone for listening, and we hope you enjoyed the show. If you are interested in more information, would like to contact us, or if you would like to support the podcast, check out our website, actualastronomy.com.